If you wanted an outline, I hope that you remembered they are going to be each week on the table in the foyer. There are some out there. I presume there are some still out there. If you did not get one. But hopefully you have one if you want one. Tonight we're going to be getting more into the book. We've been doing talking about a number of preliminary things. We've had lessons looking at the geography and the dating of the book. And then we did our first, as we will do as I overview the book, doctrinal studies that are pertinent, of course, to the discussion of the book. And we looked at Satan last week and talked about his position in this whole situation. Indeed, we'll mention Satan a number of times tonight, as you can tell if you're looking at your outline. But more, I'm going to focus on Job himself and you might say the ordeal or what he goes through. And as we are setting up what is the bulk of the book, we'll begin that next Sunday night, as we start looking at what are often called cycles of speeches or rounds of speeches or whatever, really a cross-examination back and forth between Job and his companions. But you will see that as we get into it. If you're looking at the book, let's start off by saying what Job suffers in this book, and let me just put up a chart. Job suffers in this book what might be considered three stages, so to speak, of suffering. If one looks at it, and you can tell it, as I put at the top of the outline, there are three stages that unfold in the book, so to speak. In the first stage, stage one, obviously, as most people are very familiar with, Job suffers total loss, as we'll get into talking about. But he loses everything that he has materially, etc. In stage two, Job is stricken by Satan personally. He suffers what we might just simply call a physical affliction, and we'll discuss more about that. Stage three comprises the majority of the book, better than two-thirds of it, and has to do with his companions, his friends, whatever you want to call them. But they visit him, obviously, as Ed read for us a moment ago from the end of chapter 2. And when they visit him, there is a number of, there is a trial in that. And we're going to discuss that and look at that at length. But he suffers, certainly, through that. Let's go back, though, and look, if you will, pick up with me in chapter 1 and verses 9 through 22 in the latter part of chapter 1. Now, remember, we're not going to go back through it, but Satan has come, and the sons of God, I believe those are righteous people, have presented themselves before God. God has issued the challenge to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job?" And Satan then begins to challenge God. And if you look at Job chapter 1 and verse 9, we will pick up where Satan challenges God and says in verse 9, "Does Job fear God for naught?" For nothing. In other words, what he's basically saying, and we all understand that, is he's slandering Job. He's saying, you buy Job off. You bought him off. And he goes on to describe it. I mean, verse 10, he says, "Haven't you made a hedge about him and about his house and about all that he has on every side?" In other words, you've protected him completely. He doesn't have to worry about calamity. He doesn't have to worry about enemies. That's what he's really getting at. Because you hedge him about. You protect him on every side. Not only that, but everything he touches turns to gold, as we would say. You prosper him in everything that he does. You bless, quote unquote, verse 10, the work of his hands. He challenges God. He slanders Job. He falsely accuses God, because he's not just saying, "God, you've blessed Job, so it's no wonder." He's really saying, "You've done it to that end. You've given him what he's gotten to get him to be this great, faithful, completely faithful servant." And what he's doing in saying that, he's slandering both God and Job. And Job is not righteous. He's not someone that just willingly serves you, to use God's language. But rather, he simply is responding to that. He doesn't want to lose what he's got. He knows that if he stops serving you, he stops prospering. So Satan then issues a challenge to God. If you look at verse 11, Satan says to God, obviously, "Put forth your hand now, touch all that he has, and he'll curse you to your face." And that's the challenge. He says, take it away, you lose Job. It's that simple. Job will not be faithful to you if you take it away. So God, we might say, I'm going to have one good cough here, I'm sure, is coming. But we might say God sort of acquiesces to that. He gives in to that to a degree. He says in verse 12, behold, all that he has is in your power. Okay. We'll see, so to speak. Take everything he has, or at least do with it as you will. You do what you want. And I still say he will serve me. So he sort of acquiesces, but obviously he offers or gives here a restriction. And we know that. Let's read verse 12 together. The Lord said unto Satan, behold, all that he has is in your power. Only upon himself put not forth your hand. So Satan went forth from the presence of the Lord, and basically he sets about to do it. Now, in what unfolds here, in very quick fashion, Job begins to go through something very much like I think we can sympathize with or empathize perhaps to a degree. Because it seems, we say things like when it rains, it what? And everybody says, yeah, it pours, right? And it seems like when something bad happens, you'll hear people, and I'm amazed at all of the terminology or cliches that people have for it. Bad news comes in threes. And all of that kind of thing. And you can probably think of a lot more. But what I'm getting at is this. We're aware of the fact that it seems when it turns bad or it goes wrong, it piles up. You don't just have usually one crisis or one problem or one calamity. You have several. If there's a sickness, there's a bunch of it. If there's deaths, there are several of them, et cetera, et cetera. And what happens, and maybe that's not by pure coincidence. I think sometimes it is. Maybe many times it is. But not always. As it is in the case with Job here, it's not coincidental. It is all at the hands of Satan. And Satan is doing it in quick fashion because Satan knows and understands that Michael might be able to endure a calamity. But if I pile a bunch of things up on him, he's got his limits. We all do. Now, as we said last week, and I'm not discounting or discrediting, God knows the limits of Job. And God knows them better than Satan. So God allows Satan to go to the limit, but not beyond. And so it is with you, and so it is with me. But it often feels like, and we often say, it's more than I can take. It's obviously not. If I'm still functioning, I'm still walking around, I'm still retaining my integrity, to borrow from Job, then it's not more than I can take. It's a lot. But it can't be more than I can take, or I wouldn't be taking it. And that's the point. We think about what James said, and we emphasized this in our class a few months ago. And James says in chapter 5, behold the patience, the King James says, but really the word is the endurance of Job. Job endured what Satan threw at him, but it comes in quick fashion here. In fact, there are several losses that come and begin to come very quickly. Don't want to go there yet. There are several losses that come very quickly. In fact, there are four of them. If you look beginning in verse 13, and we're, I'm sure, all well aware of this, but let's read it. There was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house. There came a messenger to Job, and he said, the oxen are plowing, the asses feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans fell down upon them. They basically stole everything you had, and they killed all your servants with the edge of the sword, and I'm the only one escaped alone to tell you. You've just lost all your donkeys, and you've lost all your sheep here at the hands of the Sabaeans. Now, very quickly, verse 16, while, notice how the Bible puts it, while he was still speaking, Job gets this report that in itself would be enough. All your oxen, all your donkeys have been taken by the Sabaeans. That would be a lot. That would be a huge loss. But while he's giving that report, notice as it says in verse 16, did I say sheep a minute ago? I might have. Anyway, with the oxen, you've lost all your oxen, all your donkeys. And while he's still giving that report, verse 16, there came also another and said, notice, the fire of God, and I want to talk about this for a second. The fire of God, he says, is fallen from heaven, has burned up your sheep. I had sheep on the brain there. But the fire of God has fallen from heaven, has burned up your sheep and your servants that were tending them and consumed them, and I'm the only one escaped alone to tell you. Now, this is interesting because, again, what happens here, notice as the way it puts it, not the fire of Satan, but the fire of God. A lot of times people have asked, what is this? And so people have explored it. You know, exactly what's going on here, the fire of God. There have been numerous suggestions to this. Was it lightning? A lot of commentators seem to believe this. It was like a storm, great storm that broke out, and lightning killed all the sheep and the servants. It would have had to have been some horrendous lightning. I mean, it's possible, but it could have been. But yet, a lot of commentators really believe, and perhaps you have a footnote or you've read a commentary that says that. Some have said there are these Arabian winds, very fierce winds, that are like fire, burning winds. And it came sweeping in from the east and, just blew upon the sheep and the servants and basically just burned them up, killed them. Maybe like a tornado, maybe like a cyclone, a sirocco, or whatever in the world those things are called. And yet, as others have pointed out, that's not what it says. What it says is it fell from heaven. So that leads some to conclude that it was kind of like it happened in Sodom and Gomorrah. We don't know, meteorite, storm, or whatever it might have been, but it was fire and brimstone, perhaps, that rained from heaven, like in Sodom and Gomorrah. Seems like there's an incident in Kings, now that I think of it, that's very similar to that. But God at times has used a natural or miraculous calamity like that to destroy, as he did with Sodom and Gomorrah. So many have said it's that. The truth is, we don't know what it is. The Bible says the fire of God. That is so ambiguous, you don't know what it is. But what is interesting, at least to me, what's interesting, and to others, is that it says a fire of God. I listened to a lot of discussions, and some of you have had discussions with me about this, and the discussions have been the bad things, quote unquote, that happen here to Job. They all happen at the hands of Satan and Satan only. Well, maybe. But even though this is under the direction of Satan, in other words, he wants to afflict Job and kill all the sheep, it's still called the fire of God. Now, is God raining the fire down? I don't think so, personally. Is it something that God created that Satan is allowed to use? Or maybe I should rephrase it, misuse. That's very possible. And unless you jump all over me and say, that's crazy, let me get you to consider something. Read in the book of Revelation, for example, a couple of other incidents, very difficult passages to determine what it's talking about. But think of false wonders, false signs, false miracles. And yet, as Paul describes it, for example, in 2 Corinthians 10 and 11, it's real enough that it can mislead. It's real enough that if Christians weren't careful in those days, they could believe it. So what I'm getting at is simply this. Some would conclude that what you have at times are miraculous things or natural things that, generally speaking, God has created and God uses exclusively. But in cases like this, where God allows Satan to tempt, try, etc., Satan can take those things or use or utilize those things and pour out something upon God's people. Now, again, I don't know exactly what this is. And I offer all of that to you. You can think about that, go home, ponder it, look at some other things, what other people have to say. But in the end, all we know is that God says a fire of God killed all of his sheep. Now, as we go further with it, while he was speaking, if you can just picture this in your mind, these servants are running up to Job and telling him all this bad news, and one doesn't get through before the other one speaks. The third thing happened, verse 17. While he's still speaking, there came another. It said the Chaldeans came like an army made out of three bands, fell upon the camels and carried them away. In fact, they killed the servants that were tending to them. So not only have you lost your oxen and your donkeys, not only have you lost your sheep, not only have you lost all your servants that were tending to them, now apparently his last bit of wealth, material wealth, and wealth was counted in those days in terms of herds, His camels are all gone. He's gone from maybe in an hour's time, in 5 minutes' time. I mean, how long would it take three servants to come up and give a short report like this? In 5 minutes' time, he's gone from perhaps the wealthiest individual in the land to broke. I mean, you imagine if that happened to you. Maybe you worked all your life. Remember, Job is at least what we would consider middle age. He's been working for a while. He's got grown children here. You put yourself in his position. You've worked hard. You've built up wealth. You've built up what should be security in your old age. And in 5 minutes' time, you lose everything you've got. I mean, just that, what would it do to you? Now, let's not just dismiss this and act like, oh, well, it's a Bible story and we know Job's. I mean, what if that was you? Now, if all of that's not bad enough, the fourth stage is arguably, by any of us, absolutely the worst thing that could ever happen to parents. While he was still speaking, verse 18, maybe in that same 5 minute span, a fourth came to him and said, "Your sons and your daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house. And there came a great wind from the wilderness, and it smote the four corners of the house, and it fell upon the young men, and they are dead. And I only am escaped alone to tell you." Now that's devastating. To lose all of your material wealth would blow most of us away. But if in the same few minutes somebody came and reported, not only everything you've worked for all your life is gone, but your whole reason for doing that. I mean, to most people, when you get to be my age, middle age, or whatever, when you get to be this age, I mean, you don't look at life the same. And I think all of us, you know, 40s, 50s, and beyond will readily admit that to younger people. You just don't look at life the same. You're not young any longer, and you don't look at it like that. And you're not thinking in terms of a young person with, quote, unquote, your whole life ahead of you. And you're not building for that great, what to you young people is a great distant future. You've lived that. And now you begin to look at life going on and extending on. You look at your children. If you have children, if you don't, it's different. I understand that. But if you have children, you begin to focus your attention on your children. You think in terms of grandchildren. You think in terms of legacy and heritage and inheritance and all of that kind of thing. But the children become the focus of your dreams and your hopes and all of that. I'm sure a lot of you can relate to that. He loses that. They're all gone. All his children are removed in an instant's time. A storm came, a wind came, knocked the house down, and just coincidentally, all your kids were there. Every one of them. Not a one alive. It reminds me of a story, Deb. It reminds me of a story. Some of you may be familiar with it. That happened in the 1800s. And a fellow that I began to hear about after I became a member of the church, been a member of the church for a couple of years, his name is Horatio Spafford. I think Horatio Gates Spafford, but I didn't write that down. His name is Horatio Spafford, and Spafford was an attorney that lived in Chicago in the 1800s. And he lived there. He became fairly wealthy, you know, prominent attorney. Invested in a lot of real estate as the city was booming. And if you go back and read in the late 1800s after the Civil War, it really boomed. It grew rapidly. And he invested in real estate and became quite wealthy. And then, whether it was Mrs. O'Leary's cow or whatever, but you know, the fire started. And the fire started and burned most of Chicago. And he lost almost everything he had worked for to that point in his life. His real estate burned up, and this is way before the days of extensive insurance and all of that kind of thing. He just lost it. And so he basically had to start over. But he was a very positive individual. He's that kind of person usually is successful. So he set about, you know, built it once, I'll build it again. So he set about to build it again. And if you read his story over the next couple of years, he had a positive attitude, comes out of the fire being one of those people that leads to the rebuilding of Chicago. And everything is going wonderful. He's back on his feet in 1873 and decides, I've been working hard for a couple of years. I've got a good friend, D.L. Moody. Bible students will know D.L. Moody is one of the great preachers of the day. Moody was touring England at the time. Why don't you come over here? We'll enjoy a holiday together. I'm going to be doing some speaking, some preaching. And, come over here and let's have a holiday together. Basically, Spafford said, I've earned this. You know, I've been working hard. And so I'm going to take a vacation. He had some business things he had to take care of. So basically, he said to his wife and his kids, you guys go on over. And then I'll catch a late, and at that time, it was a boat, not a plane. But I'll catch a later ship, and I'll come right behind you, and then we'll enjoy a holiday together. And you can guess, of course, what happened. Almost 2 years to the day after the fire, given a month, in November of 1873, he sent his wife and his daughters across on, let's see, what was the ship's name? The Villa de Havre. And this thing, as it was sailing across the Atlantic Ocean, was struck by another ship. And as would be the case in those days, when two ships collided, they sank. And when they sank, 226 people died, including Horatio Spafford's four daughters. And they were aged 11, 9, 5, and 2. He got a report from his wife. Of course, this is not the days of phones and cell phones and instant news and everything. But he got a telegram from his wife that began, as those dreaded things did in that day, I arrived in England alone and told him his four daughters were dead. They had died on November 22nd, 1873. Spafford caught his ship, but not to join his family on vacation, but to grieve and bury his four daughters. And while he was passing across on the Atlantic, he wrote the song that you probably sung many times in your life, It Is Well With My Soul. That's incredible faith. To lose everything and to be able to write a song that no doubt has comforted countless thousands and tens of thousands through the years. It is well with my soul. How did Job respond? Look at verse 20. Job arose and rent his mantle and shaved his head and fell down upon the ground and worshipped. And he said, naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. In all this, Job sinned not, nor charged God foolishly. It's incredible. Job responded, he mourned, in the way that people mourned in that day. He tore his clothing. He shaved the hair off his head. We would do other things, it doesn't matter. He grieved. And he worshipped. He didn't curse God. He didn't quit God. He didn't say, I'm through with God. I've had enough of God. He worshipped. And he didn't sin. That's an incredible response from a righteous man. I'm sorry, I get broken up sometimes when I think about all of this. But you imagine what Satan must have been thinking. I throw all of this at this fool, and he worships God. I throw all of this at this fool, and he doesn't curse God. He's got to be sitting there wondering why. He's human. He's normal. Why does it happen? I was doing everything I knew to do. I was worshiping God. I was being the most righteous person that I know, and for that matter, that anybody knew. Why would this happen? He's not given the answer. He's just given the situation. And unfortunately for him at this time, he's got to deal with it and believe, trust in God. Now you'll notice what happens here, and it's interesting, because I don't want us to miss this. If you look in chapter 2, If we're not careful, we think that what happened is Satan went running back to God and said, okay, well, all right, God, but if you, you know, afflict him personally. That's not what happened here. And it's not that Job had to lose everything, and that night God came to him in a vision and said, Job, let me explain it to you. Time passes. If you read this carefully, you'll look at verse 1 of chapter 2, and you'll see the phrase where it says, again, there was a day. Some have said that in all likelihood, the presenting themselves to God was a yearly event. At best, it's a periodical event. I mean, we know that days like this, judgment days, feast days, days set aside by God, are a periodical event. They may come weekly, monthly, yearly, but in all likelihood, by the description that's given here, this might very well have been an annual event. And if it is, he goes a year like this. No answers, no reasons, just you lose everything. But regardless, some time passes. Again, there was a day, and everybody came to present themselves before God. And Satan came among them, and the Lord said to Satan, where'd you come from? And Satan said, well, I've been parading the earth. And the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? Notice, God adds something. There's none like unto him in all the earth, a perfect upright man. He fears God, he eschews evil, and still he holds fast his integrity. Don't miss that. You didn't win, Satan. He still holds his integrity. Although you moved me. Now think back to the fire of God. Some do look directly at what God says here and say that at times even God will directly do things. I'm not convinced totally of that, but it is an indication. And moved me, he said, to Satan, to move against him, or provoked me, or however your translation reads. To destroy him without cause. Now Satan again issues the challenge to God. And basically what Satan says is, you afflict him personally, he'll curse you to your face. If he's physically afflicted, he'll curse you. Skin for skin, all that a man has, he'll give for his life. I look at this, to me, this is the downfall of Satan personally. When I look at Satan, I see something very... Well, let me just say it like this. This exposes Satan for where Satan falls or fails right here. Satan was created by God with the ability to appreciate God, to worship God, to love God. There isn't any question in my mind about that. God has never created something that wasn't good, wasn't perfect. I don't believe that Satan was a flawed individual from his creation. But where so many people, and yes, angels, a Gabriel, for example, where so many of you, of us, have a love for God and an integrity within us that says, I have to do it because it's right. I must do it, regardless. Satan doesn't have that. Satan isn't motivated by love. I mean, even to the extent, look at it here. If you were looking at the calamities in chapter 1, and I don't think I'm, you know, going off the deep end and saying this. I think most every one of us in here, if we look at that list of things that happened to Job, all four of those things in chapter 1, and I said, what's the worst thing that happened? All of you would say, losing his children. I mean, take my cars and my houses and so forth, but don't take my kids. But Satan doesn't see that. Doesn't understand that. There's not love in Satan to understand that. God is love, not Satan. I mean, you would give your life. I have no doubt about this. There are people in this room that would give their life for their child. If a doctor comes to you and says, your child is going to die unless you give up one of your kidneys, cut me today. I'm sorry, but that's the way it is. You know, I love my child. And I love my child more than my life. I mean, that's just the way good people, right-thinking people are. And you don't have to be the best person in the world to feel that way. But Satan doesn't feel that. Listen to that ridiculous statement again in verse 4.
Skin for skin, yea, all that a man has will he give for his life. Is that true of you? Would you give everything for your life? Would you give your children's lives to save your own? I don't think most people in here would do that. I'm not saying anybody would. But I think you could easily say about a room full of people that most people would not. But Satan don't get it. And that's why Satan doesn't understand Job. Satan doesn't understand Job because Satan doesn't understand there are things within good people that are more important than life. Start with their own children. All that a man has, will he give for his life? No, he won't. But put forth your hand, he issues this challenge to God. Touch his bone and his flesh, and he'll curse you to your face. God says, he's in your hand. The only restriction I give this time is, you can't kill him. Spare his life. Now, Job's affliction comes, and it in itself, there's a lot of ambiguity about it. What is the affliction? Well, it's easy to read it. Verse 7, Satan went forth from the presence of the Lord. It's almost as if he fell all over himself to do it. Immediately, he smote Job with, quote-unquote, sore boils from the sole of his foot to his crown or the top of his head. Bottom of his feet to the top of his head. But what is this? There have been a lot of suggestions about what it is. And I'm going to give you the most popular ones. I've read and read and read and read trying to see what everybody has to say. And here are the most popular ones. Boils. It is what it says. It's boils. But, as many people will point out to you, unless it's something miraculous and out of the ordinary, I mean, I've had boils, and some of you have had them, no doubt, and usually you get a boil. Maybe one, two, or three at the most. But you don't get boils, not normally, like this. From the bottom of your feet to the top of your head. So is it boils? Well, maybe it is. I mean, the word itself means, and it's very broad. It can mean almost anything because it just means an inflammation. It's a term that means an ulcer or literally a burn. It can be anything. So some have suggested what it is leprosy. I mean, the dreaded disease of the day, right? Leprosy. And they say, as you begin to look at the description of the symptoms in the book, well, maybe so. I mean, the descriptions in the book, for example, look down later in chapter 2 when the friends came, verse 12, they lifted up their eyes, they saw him from a distance, and quote-unquote, they knew him not. Many have suggested that the reason they didn't know him is because he was so disfigured. In other words, like he had a rapidly advancing leprosy attack or whatever it might be. And so this thing came on him, and leprosy will do that. I mean, it will make you appear horribly and disfigure you. And the more advanced the disease gets, if it covered your entire body, would be the idea, you would be completely disfigured. And there are other descriptions in the book. I mean, if we look later in the book, we see Job talking about having an intense fever at one point, he says in one of the speeches. Or another place he talks about burning literally in his bones. Now that in itself is a symptom of leprosy. There are other things described as well. He apparently describes very graphically in chapter 7, you can look at this for yourself, in chapter 7 and verse 5, he describes the idea of worms being in his open sores. And many have pointed out that someone like this, I'm not trying to get sickening here, but the idea of having open sores and so forth, of many different diseases, and worms would attack you and all of that kind of thing. So, is it a normal boil that's usually caused by a staph infection? Is it some other kind of quote-unquote boils? I mean, miosis, for example, where you get these what looks like boils on you after you've been bitten by, a tumbler fly in Africa or a blowfly, and you get this kind of parasitic attack. Is it that kind of thing? It might be. But as you look at it, it might be leprosy. It might be what many people mistakenly call elephantitis, and really the correct pronunciation is elephantiasis. The idea of this disease that comes on you and disfigures part of your body and your skin begins basically to look like an elephant's skin is what it amounts to. But this disease, one reason why is because commonly in a person with elephantiasis, They'll have worms. A particular kind of worm tends to attack these people. It's not really boils or anything, but it is something associated with that. So that's been one suggestion. However, with both leprosy and elephantiasis, both of these things, it's not like individual boils that would appear all over your body. It's like a patch of skin that's covered, maybe a foot in area, whatever it might be. It's led many to say what he really had was not boils or leprosy or anything like that, but he really had smallpox. And if you look at pictures, I mean, smallpox is supposed to be, right now, currently, an eradicated disease. Vaccine came out, of course, and since the late 70s, killed it out, and then I think there was a very small outbreak that killed it out again. But if you look at pictures of people with smallpox, even back in the 70s or when I was a kid, you can see that it resembles, not exactly, but it does resemble having hundreds of boils on your body. Not exactly, but it resembles it. So some have said, really, he had smallpox. I'll give you another indication why. You'll notice what he did here. Look down when it says, where am I looking for? Verse 8, when it says he took a potsherd, like a broken piece of pottery, to scrape himself. Now, many people have looked at that and said, well, he's lancing the boils. Again, I'm not trying to be sickening, but, you know, you have to talk about it. But others have said that's not what's going on. Something that's associated with smallpox is an intolerable, intense itching. In fact, so much so that people in extreme cases where they're alive and they're still trying to save their life, they would be itching so bad they would literally have to tie their arms and their feet down to keep them from scratching the pox or pustules and causing an infection that would, that's what generally killed some people who had a resistance to it. And so they would just tie them down to keep them from scratching. And so they say what you see in Job is he's got smallpox and he's sitting down and just literally scratching himself because he's itching so badly. Now, I don't know what he's got. And I don't think it matters. I went through all of that because it's a curiosity and has been for perhaps 3,000-4,000 years. But what it is an intense disease, a discomfort. So much so that Job at this point, you'll notice the reaction here. Incredibly, he reacted in chapter 1 by mourning, grieving, worshiping God, a resolve to go on. In chapter 2, he doesn't quit, he doesn't give up, but he just stops living. I mean, there isn't any other way to describe this situation. He was naturally despondent. The Bible just describes him as, notice here, he took a potsherd to scrape himself and he just sat down. And it's interesting when it says he sat down among the ashes. If you look at the root word of this term, ashes, it's like the garbage heap. It's the ashes of the trash where they burned it outside the city. And chances are great that, and that's one reason why people say it's leprosy, because he withdrew himself to keep other people from catching it or one of these other infectious diseases. But nonetheless, he just goes outside the city and sits down in the garbage. He just stops living, is the point. And I'm not sure that any of the rest of us wouldn't be exactly like this. And what's the point? I mean, what does he have to live for? You might say, well, he's still married. Well, is he? I mean, when you read this, his wife came to him in verse 9 and said, do you still retain? That's another indication that some time has been passing here and he's gone on worshiping God. He's gone on with a resolve to live, kind of like, you know, I was describing earlier with Spafford, it is well with my soul. But when he reaches this point, it's not that he's cursing God. He's not doing that. And yet, he's not going on either. He's just kind of doing nothing. And his wife comes to him, and what is she saying to him? All the translations, except for one or two obscure ones, say she said to him in verse 9, curse God and die. But you know something interesting? If you look at this in the original language, it doesn't say curse God and die. Interestingly enough, there are many times the word curse is used in the Bible. You know, and I mean, we can see that a number of times. And yet, this is not that word. In fact, what this word is and what she literally says to him is, bless God and die. And yet, no major translation translates it bless. They translate it curse. Why not? I mean, is she getting a bum rap? We've all said about her, you know. Job's wife, you know, came to him and said, curse God and die, curse God and die. And that's one of the most famously quoted phrases of a wife to her husband out of the Bible. Curse God and die. Is that a bum rap? Did she really say to him, was she really encouraging Job? And saying to him, basically, just let that be enough, Job. Some have said that. She really just saying, look, you've retained your integrity. Do you still retain your integrity? All right, great. Then give God a final blessing and let it go. It's kind of like you might whisper to a person that's just desperately hanging on to life and there's no point. Just let it go. You lived a good life. You lived a faithful life. There is not a reason. You have nothing. You have nothing. You have no wealth. You have no business. You have no children. You have no health. You have no reason to keep going. Just die. And being merciful about it. Now, which is it? Well, actually, I don't think it's either. I think if you look at it carefully, she does say, I mean, I respect the original language. She does say to him, bless God and die. But I think you have to look at it in its context. Let's read the whole statement. Look at verse 9. Do you still retain your integrity? Bless God and die. However she said what she said, Job's response to her was, you speak like a fool. So it's not positive. She's not getting a bum rap. And I think the reason the translators translated curse God and die is because that's the sentiment here. She's mockingly saying to him, he's been blessing God. He's been, blessed be the name of the Lord, chapter 1, verse 21. She's mockingly, sarcastically saying to him, she's overcome herself. You know, let's not forget this, incidentally. We focus so much on Job in this book that I think sometimes we forget Job ain't the only one that suffered all the losses in chapter 1. So did she. She's his wife. And presumably, she's the mother of the children. She lost everything too. Now, is she as good a man as Job? Is she as strong a godly individual as Job? Obviously not. But put yourself in her shoes. I ain't as strong as Job either. And if I went through all of this, what would I be like? So I think she's saying she's had enough. And while he is just kind of, you know, turn the engine off, she's letting it come out. And she's sarcastically saying to him, bless God if you want to, but get it over with. Bless God and die. Do you still retain your integrity? He said, you're a fool. You speak like one of the foolish women speaks. But what do you think? Do we receive good at the hand of God? And do we not receive evil? Does he understand it? No. But he's not going to sin with his lips. He just sits there. And that's where we'll leave it to next week. He just sits there. And in fact, his three friends, who knows how long he sits there? I mean, this is not a matter of 5 minutes. He may sit there days, weeks. We don't know. His friends hear about it, and I remind you of the geography we were putting up here. From three different parts of Saudi Arabia, at least, they come. He sits there long enough for his friends to travel to where he is. And when they get there, notice verse 13. They sit down with him and nobody says a word for a week. Can you imagine that? They don't know what to say. They're waiting for him to say something. And he hasn't spoken. The last thing he has said, who knows how long ago, is, "Wife, you're a fool. You speak like a fool." And then he stops. The first thing he will say is what he says in chapter 3. And it's really pitiful. And that's where we're going to start next Sunday.